For the dates for each week and so on? What chapters for what week? Did that get printed up? I sent to Joe last week. Did Joe not get the... Okay, I didn't send it. Well, does everyone understand that we're dealing with the printed book and then the Xerox book? Printed is the third edition, the Xerox book is the fourth. Chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6 are the same in both editions. And so since tonight we're dealing through chapter 2, and next week we're dealing with chapter 3, you're safe for one cycle. The content isn't different, but the presentation is better in chapter 4. As I expressed to you in the email that I sent out that many of you got, Swami himself said that when he had the leisure to really look at the book, he just thought it could be said better. And since it's not, as he put it, it's kind of heavy going, he thought if it was more fun to read, people would be more inclined to read it. It's one of his principles of writing, is to get a little more fun. Okay, so do we have any general questions or questions even about what we've already read? Yes, Rick. They're in the teaching center already, yeah. And they're very nice, so you can get them easily. Okay. This book of Swamiji's, I don't think he actually explains it in the preface anymore. At one point it was in the preface, but one of the early editions he told this. I think it might have been Richard Salva, but somebody from Book Buyers, I think, sent Swamiji the copy of a book that was called Books That Changed the World or something like that. He refers to it in chapter 1. He just makes references, so-and-so says in this book, Books That Changed the World. And they just thought that Swami, would you just be interested in it? And he read through it, and he really was struck by the collection of essays by each of these different individuals or about them. I don't really know what the book itself was, because he realized it really did describe sort of the... progress, you could either call it the progress into our present state or the progressive deterioration into our present state of sort of what you might call cultural attitudes that mold our thinking in the West. And Swamiji, after reading that, had two thoughts that both were interesting. One was that even for devotees, we're very often captured by cultural assumptions like fish swimming in water that we don't even know form the biases of the way that we view the world. And as we endeavor to re-educate ourselves towards self-realization, sometimes we don't exactly know what ignorances we're working with because we don't know their ignorances, we just think they're facts. We face this in a peculiar sense in our elementary school, because our elementary school is not parochial in that we're not indoctrinating them. Our goal is not to indoctrinate them so that they'll come out to be little self-realizationists of Ananda. Although, if they all grew up and decided that the search for God was everything and had the karma to drop it all and go live in the Himalayas, we wouldn't necessarily complain. But that isn't like we don't limit our goal to that. In this sense, I'm reminded of a young woman, a child who was part of Ananda, and she became very enamored of Saint Bernadette of Lourdes and the children of Fatima, who had visions of Mother Mary. In fact, David and I visited some of those places, and we came back. We went to her house. She was just a child, and we showed her slides, and it was so exciting to her. Well, she worked it out and realized that pretty much everybody that she'd heard about who was a child who'd had a vision of Mother Mary was a shepherd. And so she developed the lifelong ambition to be a shepherd, which had certain practical implications because there were many subjects in school that were not necessary. She already knew more than enough math to count the sheep. It was very reasonable. She has maintained her deep spirituality, although she's gone beyond her ambition to be a shepherd at this point in her life. But in our situation with our school children, it's not parochial, but it is definitely spiritually based. It's really based on self-realization. And self-realization is not parochial. It's not Ananda self-realization. That's the difference. But nonetheless, in the context of having the teachers who are all part of Ananda who have educated themselves in Master's point of view, have certain concepts, for example, about world history. Because once you introduce the yugas, the idea of great cycles of time, in which circular cycles of time, in which we're emerging from Kali Yuga, coming into Dwapara Yuga, it has a very profound effect on how you teach a lot of history. Because you open these little history books and they talk about, you know, man was like this and he's gone in this progressive straight line for thousands upon thousands of years, and now we've reached the apex of all development, which is us. And so history becomes somewhat problematic. Certainly the question of evolution becomes problematic. Many biological facts become problematic. Not all subjects really are a difficulty, but many really are. And we've had to just like try to figure out how can we educate them in such a way that they can blend into the mass culture, but not just, we can't just stand there and lie to them. We can't just stand up and say things that we simply don't believe are true. Now, a lot of, I was saying, we face that in a small issue because we have to conform to certain cultural assumptions. Well, what Swami does so interestingly in this book, and he outlines it for us completely, he warns us completely in the first chapter what he's going to do. He shows us sort of how we've moved from the kind of dogmatic theology that was represented by the Catholic Church, which was the only Western church at that time, really, the only significant Western church. I mean, others, I mean, the Jews existed and various other people existed, but all power has been concentrated in the Catholic Church, was almost exclusively for centuries and centuries, especially in Europe before there was America, where even when you go now, one of the reasons that we changed our name from Ananda Church to Ananda Sangha, which is still sort of a confusing mishmash. We're just sometimes Ananda Church of Self-Realization when the mood strikes us, and sometimes we're Ananda Sangha, meeting in the Self-Realization Mandir, if that's how we happen to feel. But one of the reasons we made that shift is because as our work began to develop in Europe, church was simply an impossible word. It's an English word to begin with, so you face that dilemma, but even if you just translate it into French or Italian, because the church is the Catholic Church. And also, it was just beyond preposterous to our European friends that you would found a church. You know, this is a very American concept. You don't found churches, there simply is a church, the church. In fact, when we were buying this church from the Catholics, a group of Italian friends were visiting us as it happened, and they didn't, not all of them spoke English well, so we were dealing with translations. But they gradually cognized that we were having a discussion about the fact that we were about to buy a Catholic church. And there's all this whispered Italian conversation, great puzzlement, you know, you must have the translation wrong, in essence. And then the spokesman, the commission spokesperson, asked for a clarification, and then there was more discussion, because it just couldn't get their minds around it. Now, that's important, because even though we're not Europeans, except by descent, I mean, not some of us are, some of us aren't, but that whole way of thinking is still part of our reality, and the whole influence of institutionalism to determine reality, because that's really what the Catholic Church represents. And Swamiji writes about this here, that the Catholic Church designated itself not merely as the arbiter of theological truth, but simply as the arbiter of truth, because theological truth was everything. And there's still, and this is just human nature, this, it doesn't matter, it's the same in India. As Yogananda said, ignorance is pretty even 50-50 East and West. No one side or the other has a monopoly on it, they just color it in their own way. But many things are entirely human nature. I love where Swami uses the phrase, how does he put it? He said that the church didn't invent dogmatism. They merely just sort of institutionalized the natural human tendency to want to fix things in a certain way. And he says it's so interesting. You know, one of the results of Swamiji's working on a book as long as he's worked on this one is that he distills things down into just single sentences. And in his editing process, in fact, he was reading us an example where he took a whole paragraph about the relationship of superstition and love, and he just reduced it down to one sentence. And it was, the whole thought was in the one sentence, but if you weren't paying attention, you wouldn't know that. There's many sentences that are extremely complicated in here. They don't seem complicated, and that's the worst of it, because you don't really know it. I want to find this, so just a second. I think it must be talking about a later chapter. sorry, I know all this turning of pages is going to end up on the tape recorder. Yeah, it's in chapter 2 that I was talking about, but I can skip to it. He said, what the church did primarily was empower people's natural resistance to change. It's just such a marvelous phrase, isn't it? It just gave it the imprint of divine authority that now we can say this is the way things are and they can never change. Interestingly, and I don't want to diverge too much, but a friend of mine gave me a book that's a popular book. It's called A History of the Catholic Church. And it's not well written, but it's very interesting. It has too many words. Someone once accused Mozart of one of his pieces having too many notes. He didn't accept that. But sometimes you read books that have too many words. They should have pared it down. But this man was writing about, from a devout Catholic's point of view, but he was talking about how many times the absolute theology had shifted. And what was absolutely true from divine authority a few centuries later wasn't. And what was now true was absolutely true from divine authority, and then it would shift again. But fortunately, most people don't know history. And so you can just sort of... But that empowering people's natural resistance to change is a very strong and a very simple thought. So what Swamiji really wants to get across in this book, and this is, in a sense, and this is why, even if the subject matter of this book doesn't feel as much as devotional, for example, as the book we last did, or God Alone, or something like that, it's very, very important for us to understand this book for several reasons. Number one, we do live in this society and we are influenced by it. And if we read it very carefully and study it very carefully, we may realize that we are unreasonably prejudiced. We are boxed into certain ideas that we think of as true, but are merely just the way we've grown accustomed to thinking because we're a product of our age. And secondarily, Swamiji feels this is an extremely important book, and often he often says this is the most important book I've written, but he has said about this, because, let me think about how to say this. In the Bhagavad Gita, when the question is asked by Arjuna about divine incarnations, in Christianity, you know, they never have to explain Jesus as a divine incarnation, since he was the only one ever was, ever will be, it's just really simple. He was a miracle and that's that. The Indian tradition, of course, has a long tradition of divine incarnations coming and then coming again and coming again. So they've had to think more about what the dynamic of this is. So Arjuna asks Krishna the question in the Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna answers, whenever virtue declines and vice predominates, I, the Infinite Spirit, take human form to defeat the adharmic forces and to reestablish virtue in the world. So what has happened now is there's been this new descent. You know, that light has descended anew. Every Sunday in our Festival of Light, we say the divine light has ascended anew in our line of masters. It's sort of a shift in the festival, because first we're talking about how, in very general terms, the bird flies around and learns its lesson, and the masters are very willing to sacrifice their own freedom in order to help us. But then we come to a new ray of light has descended through our line of masters. And it sweeps in the whole line. It's, you know, beginning with Babaji and moving through to the present of Paramahansa Yogananda. But it's because there was this call of aspiring love and it was necessary to bring this new ray. And so this new ray has come with a very specific message. And again, all of you, either within your own selves, because we all need to understand this more clearly, or, I mean, I look around and I know I've had conversations with different ones of you saying, how do I explain what this path is about to the people who ask me? And not being able to explain it is also, I mean, when you finally know it, you can also explain it. But what is this path we're on? Well, this path is the descent of spirit, because mankind is in trouble. The planet is in trouble again. You know, vice is predominating, virtue is declining. It doesn't really take an oracle to notice that. If you can read the newspapers for more than one day, you can find out that virtue is declining and vice is predominating. And it's just becoming the way things are. It's just the way people look at the world. And part of the virtue that's declining is hope. Part of the virtue that's declining is optimism and idealism, and certainly devotion and theism of any kind of a sense of divinity. It's just becoming unbearably materialistic, and as a result, people are becoming increasingly deranged and unhappy because there's absolutely nothing to hold them together. And yet, simultaneously, a prayer of love went up from earth, and God responded to the call of aspiring love. There are these two currents that are happening simultaneously, which is Kali Yuga in its death throes and Dwapara Yuga in its birth throes, basically. And all of the different forces are incarnated on the planet at the same time. I think this would be an appropriate time to tell you one of the more interesting little bits of anecdotal things that Swamiji said many years ago when he was talking about the planet at this time. And he talked about essentially four groups of people. Let's see, yeah, four groups of people incarnated on this planet at the same time in the West, and how all those forces are playing together to both destroy Kali Yuga and create Dwapara Yuga all at the same time. And he said, on the one side, on the death of Kali Yuga side, which is the death of the materialistic age, which is what we see going on all around us, and also this frantic sort of like, you know, over-materialism, like materialism is slipping away, so we've just got to grab it and exaggerate it. And this is not going to be over tomorrow. I mean, this is going to go on for a long time. You have, Swamiji said, you have the group of people who lived in Rome, who were just the completely debauched group that lived in Rome, and at the very end of that culture, when it just completely became so immoral and so over-sensual and so just deranged in that direction, and all those old Romans who brought that culture down. He said, and that's mostly the Hollywood set, the entertainment set, you know, the celebrity set, you know, maybe even the actors and a lot of the athletes and so on. But just these people who seem to have a completely different moral code than everyone else. It's just this very strange group of the super beautiful people, you know, wandering around just being deranged. And then you have another group helping to tear down Kali Yuga, which, I mean, this is just something Swami wrote in a letter once. And he said, these are the people who were part of the continent of Atlantis, which Atlantis fell apart at the apex of, at the height, the decline of the Satya Yuga. It was beginning to come down the other side, and the transition from Satya into Dwapara going down, when the island of Atlantis sank, which Plato wrote about, and Master confirmed that all of those things really happened. And the Atlanteans, the ones who helped destroy it, became so obsessively technological and sort of scientific, and they were in such a competition with natural forces rather than in cooperation with them. And they were mastering the planet with the power and will and, you know, dynamic technology and so on. And they also became just perverse and deranged and created so much dissonance, which is a certain of what you see now, that they created natural cataclysms. And some people who talk about the future in terms of the decades here talk about natural cataclysms being created, and Master himself said that natural cataclysms are created by mankind's wrong thinking.